Senior board member, I'm going to call a Human Services Committee meeting to order. Roll call.
Michael Gable. David Holman. Andy Bird.
Present.
Ian Lau.
Here.
Rick Dodge.
Here.
John Poole.
Here.
Greg Russell.
Here.
Here's the governance, Megan Sutter.
Here.
Nataya Hughes.
Okay, any citizens' comments? Do we have any citizens' comments? Seeing no citizens' comments, we're going to move ahead for the approval of minutes. Is anybody? Excuse me, I'm going to get rid of that.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, the motion to approve the minutes has been a second?
Yeah.
And a second, okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Thank you. Okay, we have number four on the agenda, Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act by Mr. Gravely, Patty Hall, and Debbie Ruber. Please, go ahead.
I'm going to go first. Is everybody sitting at the table?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, as you all probably already know, I'm the head of consumer for Kenosha County. I have some numbers to go over for the past 2 years. To date, in 2017, we are at 51 active city deaths. We still have 30 cases that are still pending. Not all those cases are necessarily going to be toxicology related.
Did you say 51 deaths?
51 confirmed toxicology, toxicity deaths are confirmed. Of those 51 to date for 2017, 43 are opiate or opioid related. And of those 51, 20 are due to fentanyl or fentanyl analog.
Of the 51 or the 43? Oh, I guess it doesn't matter, right?
43, okay.
Of the 51.
Okay, so of the 51, 43 are due to opiate or opioids. And of the 51, 20 are due to fentanyl or fentanyl analog. So last year, in 2016, the entire year, we had 54 confirmed toxicity deaths. And of those 54 confirmed toxicity deaths, there were six that were due to fentanyl. So
how many opioids?
I don't have that. I believe that there's around 38 or 39. The majority of the cases that were due to opioids have been this year. So, okay, as of today, as I said, we still have the 30 cases that are pending for 2017, but not all of those cases are necessarily going to be due to toxicology. Those could fall into any range of different causes and answers. So, last year I had talked about, or no, the last meeting that I was at, I had spoken about our Kenosha County Opioid Task Force and how we started that back in February. It's based off the Lake County Opioid Initiative. And I found out what they were doing in Lake County in the Chicago area, and I was pretty, you know, shocked by their numbers that they were able to get with their programs there down to 30, their death rate down by 30% due to toxicology related deaths. So I brought that here, and we started our own version of the Kenosha County Opioid Task Force, and I'm really proud of our task force that has been meeting once a month over since last, it's been almost a year. Next month will be our anniversary, so.
How many people are on this task force?
Every meeting we have about 35 to 40 people. It's always, we have a good range of participants. We have different police departments, fire departments, VA's office, the health department, the hospitals. So yeah, we have and then the other groups like the Oxford House is there. Long-term recovery. Yeah. So.
People who lost family members.
Yeah, so it's growing.
Anybody from the DLC?
Yes, we have one. So, and not everybody is able to make it every month, but we always have between 35 and 40, so it's been pretty awesome. they have that made people participate. So in the, with all the, I'm going to pass these out to everybody. With our brainstorming of ideas and working together with the different agencies, we have.
You need to get one.
Is that Narcan?
It does involve Narcan. Narcan is not in here. There's not Narcan in here. But.
I guess we can do this.
We have developed.
I think we got that last time.
We have developed this packet in conjunction with the fire departments, hospitals, and different agencies, our task force, to give these packets out to somebody who, and they, when we initially get it, so that when the fire departments go and respond to an overdose, and then somebody doesn't want to go to the hospital, so then here's the packet to give out to the person about your health, like your information about resources and information. I was very pleased that I went on her task force meeting because I thought I was just going to give these up to the fire departments. And then everybody approached me and they all wanted in. So I got these to the hospitals, to K, to the Kenosha Sheriff's Department, to the Kenosha Fire Department. All their different stations have been outfitted with these, and they've been prepared and are keeping track of how many they've been giving out. And it's great. I have the three hospitals on board, Aurora, Kenosha, and then Greater South Kenosha, and then Greater. Yeah. I'm giving them out. And then, oh, KHGS, Kenosha, and the. They have them. Oh, yeah, I got some here. Also, they just like different agencies. I think we've had close to 600 or so packets made and given out. So, as you can see in there, we have a Q&A about, you know, frequently asked questions about overdoses, resources to reach out within the community, information about Narcan. Even a pen to, you know, write notes down, things like that. And then also with the Narcan grant too, we're able to get the pen during there and things like that. So I'm hoping that between everything that we're doing with the care grant that Debbie's going to be talking about, our opioid task force, these packets to bring down the death rate within Kenosha County. Because we have one of the highest rates within the state of overdose. If you do it at a per capita basis. So that is what we are working on in the medical examiner's office. And also with the fentanyl-related deaths and things like that, it also affects our office too. Not only with the man hours and it's a strain. It comes a strain on our office to be having to deal with so many deaths. We want to get that. We just want to get the overdose death rate down because it's something that is important to me. I know it's kind of weird coming close to it, kind of but part of us being medical examiner's office is to educate the public and get this information out, and then also working. Actually, Debbie and I have a meeting this upcoming Thursday with Joe Patente to work on the Kenosha County Opioid Task Force Facebook page. So we also have that working too. So that's where we're at.
For 51 deaths, is there any people, younger people, or
it is all over the place. We see a lot. The middle age range, you see it a lot of, but we also have, from teenagers to people who are in their 70s. So we have a wide range. Majority of our cases happen in the city of Kenosha, but we've also had a spike within the past year. Like in 2017, we've had 6 confirmed deaths in the mix this year. and the year before we had none. So we are just having that to the county. It's all over.
Is there any way to find out of those individuals that died from the opioids, who were previously taking prescription before that, that kind of moved over the heroin or the fentanyl?
I don't keep track of that. Like we have, like what I keep track of is when we have the toxicology and then we know like what the person died from. So we have, okay, say that they died of the heroin, they had Xanax, and then they had amphetamines. We don't go back and keep track of, oh, did they get this prescribed to them?
I guess you're looking at HIPAA stuff then, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, there would be privacy.
They're asking, do you do some kind of history? What he's asking is, do you do a history where you could then go back and quantify and say this person started with prescription?
We do get, yes. So we do get like a history, like when we talk to the like family and friends of the deceased, we do get like a backstory from them.
So I don't think it would be hard science, but one could put together something that has some. I don't think a scientist would approve it and say, yeah, you've got a bona fide study here, but sure, you could do some kind of look back at the history and see what it looked like.
How long after the actual overdose is the Narcan effective?
Well, there's a couple different factors that take into consideration there. One of the biggest issues is with fentanyl or the fentanyl analogs, is that with some of the fentanyl analogs, they're so powerful that they're not, the Narcan doesn't work.
You have multiple doses?
Yeah, it does. There's one like actual, that is our health educators. I think it's the actual fentanyl that we know so far that's not.
I did not know that.
No.
There are some compounds that start to see now that are Narcan free, although the vast majority of these cases are still.
Right.
Are still Narcan.
And they're giving sometimes 9 to 12 doses in the field sometimes.
Is there anything other than Narcan that could help that would work on this Narcan proof patent?
So that's one of the problems is with the fentanyl. Like you don't know if there's fentanyl when a person is using heroin. Fentanyl is 80 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. So you have just like a few specks of fentanyl and mixed it with the heroin, and there's no way to like, oh, I can see that there's fentanyl.
That's amazing. I know how powerful morphine is. I was a medic in combat medic in Vietnam, and when you tell me that, it's amazing.
Even on a patch, I've had. Yeah, it's so powerful.
Are just so horrible because if you throw in some fentanyl, you can cut your hair even more dramatically. So there's a real profit move to guys to put fentanyl in because you know the whole idea of how you make a profit in the drug in the illegal drug world is you cut it with substances from our kitchens, right? And so you can cut it much more dramatically, your heroin, if you add fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And so that's the problem we're starting to see, is that there's a real economics for a drug dealer because he can make a much larger profit if he can get his hands on enough fentanyl to spread it, on, and so that he can have less pure heroin and still have customers,
It's very sensitive. Even a patch, a fentanyl patch, are given, and it's hard to wake those people up. If you have too much, it is very hard to wake them up.
Yeah, and the patch, yeah. So somebody's prescribed a patch. And usually, like, the patch you see a lot of times you see it for somebody who's on hospice, like, end of life care. And you're only giving, like, one patch every 3 days, and then you only prescribe 10 patches for an entire month to use. And The fentanyl is like it's in powder form. It's
coming from overseas. It's mixing into the heroin supply, and you have no idea what you're. So then, how often are they having to give the Narcan? Because if they don't know, is it going to be too late? And these people are going to, you might end up losing somebody because this could happen.
We would first administer the Narcan whenever we find a person, and then give it 2 or 3 minutes after that dose is given, and every. But obviously, if PMS gets there, they can do it ID-wise.
Yeah.
then that could be on a drip, and that's what happens a lot of times when somebody's taking PPR, they'll be on a Narcan drip.
Because you're giving the inhale.
Correct.
Okay.
Not actually inhale.
Inhale, yeah.
And so there's not, like, you know, in regards to your question, there's not a specific time where I'm like, oh, up to this time that they can be saved. You don't, it's, there's not, I can't really say, oh, after this many minutes, like, you can't save them, I can't save them. Because there's respiratory depression that happens too, and then depending on like what they have used and how it's affected them, some people can take, you know, a few minutes to a couple hours to die, or some people are getting the fentanyl and they're literally like, just, they're literally dropping where they're at, and that's it.
Can I tell you guys one thing I learned when we had Narcan training? Because I've thought a lot about this, and so this is something you guys might not know, and that is that the Narcan works and should be given even before someone stops breathing. So, you know, the first sign is that kind of rough breathing where a lot of times associates of a heroin addict will think, well, that person's just snoring, right? Yeah. But it's an unnatural rough breathing. And I've been told Narcan should be given even then. So that's a person still respirating, but obviously having some issues. So I think that the public needs to hear Narcan's not just when people aren't breathing. You know, it's actually when they're having any trouble breathing, you should be administering Narcan.
Yeah, because they might be waiting for them to, like, stop breathing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, no, you gotta give it right
away. I never thought of that.
Well, there's no side effect. I mean, there's nothing bad is going to come
nothing
from
bad.
You giving it. I could give it to Supervisor Poole right now, and he's just sitting there.
In fact, we were planning that for a few
years. Let's find out.
Well, I thought I read somewhere on the internet that said that they thought there was some side effects from Narcan or something.
There's very minimal chance of coming to be allergic to the active ingredient. But
it's very unlikely. And again, if that's the case, you know, they're going to need help anyway. So there's something going on in the Narcan that's not helping out.
Yeah.
Something else.
So if they don't get this help, they're done anyway. So.
Any other questions?
So are these packets available to the, like, if somebody was asking, you know, online, let's see, where can they go to get something like this?
I have them at my office at the medical examiner office. I have extra packets here that we can get them to you. So there's a level of program for you on the website. Our website is still in progress. So we want to get that, we'll have a link on there, so that's what we can do.
Oh, and our office opens up, we'll take some too.
Did the media want to ask any questions?
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, please feel free to contact Francis.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll expand a little bit about the opioid task force because it is under the CARA grant, which is the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. We're one of 12 communities in the United States that got this grant, and we're really excited to have it because we get to learn from the other people in the country that are doing this, as well as be able to help our community. And like I said, part of it is the opioid task force, and we've been meeting since February, and the people that are on the task force really are in it to help our community. Some people have been saved by Narcan, some people are recovering, are in long-term recovery, some people currently are having family members that are going through withdrawals or are actively addicted to heroin. So it's great to have their feedback, as well as people working in the community on this subject, not only corrections and law enforcement on that end, but also the prevention area of it as well. So this group
is going to also break off into subcommittees and work on prevention, education, and awareness as one of the subcommittees. Then we have healthcare and first responders, that's going to be another one. Also have treatment and recovery, as well as the policy and legal issues. And then we're also going to have a fifth one, which will be data collection, because right now we're learning that not all departments collect the information correctly, so we can't really tell how many are go through the Narcan being administered, or how many people are saved. A lot of different issues that we're having, so we're trying to get something that's a little bit more uniform. And the first responders in not only the city, but also out in the county are very much on board with this, because they're learning as well and want to know how they can be a part of the solution. The project is a 3-year project, so we are currently in our first year. It started in October, and we also get a chance to give reports out, and we are a part of a group of with a conference call for the 12 communities that received this grant, and now we get to see what, how they're promoting this, what they're doing, as well as to show what we get to do as well. The task force is very hands-on. It's not just Patty and I sitting at the table barking out all kinds of stuff to people. It's a great information sharing. We've been having some presentations done. So usually each month we'll have somebody talk for maybe about anywhere from 15 minutes to half an hour and explain how they're involved in the opioid education or prevention or treatment, and learn a little bit about how maybe other agencies can work with them and help them out what they're doing as well. And one of our one of the things we just had was getting a person to tell their story about being in long-term recovery. And that I think is very helpful, because sometimes you might know somebody, but you don't know their story. And that was just helpful to learn a little bit about how he got to where he is at. And again, he's trying to give back, because he wants to know, or let first responders know, that it's important to do what they're doing. And he thanks them, because obviously he is alive today because of him being able to help them out. But also be, as part of this grant, we also have certified peer specialists that are going to be working in the emergency room. So if a person does come in that has overdosed, they have the opportunity to meet with this person and maybe get into recovery, or at least have somebody that they can connect with that knows what it's like. Not exactly, but have a similar journey to theirs. And crisis is going to be called when this happens, and then that certified peer support person will come out, and whether it's going to meet with the family and friends and the person that night, or it could be up to 72 hours after that, because sometimes I think people, right when they overdose, they're not really open to that, but they may be able to think about it, you know, 24 hours later and say, you know what, really, this isn't good. This is not the life that I want to live. I really want to stop doing what these drugs are doing to me and get the help that I need. So then there will be follow-up done as well, and there's going to be lots of data collected from that. There are going to be up to 5 people, I believe, hired. I believe most of those have been hired through Kenosha Human Development Services to work on this project. And again, people are in long-term recovery that are these peer specialists. And so they're going to bring their experiences and be able to help. And if the peer specialist for this grant is not available, to also a few in the community that we can call on that are either recovery coaches or have worked in them in that capacity, and they can support us in this effort as well. The other thing that I just wanted to mention too is we will be also having a survivor's support group. So if somebody has lost to an overdose, and we don't only mean by death, but we can also mean that maybe I have a brother and he was addicted to drugs and wandered off, and I have seen him for years. That's also a loss that people sometimes if they're dead or alive, or however old they are, they need that support as well. So we'll be offering that by the end of January, if not in February. And
Hi-Sec Altos is going to offer us their family service center on 52nd Street until we get to the first base, and we're on to that. Questions for me?
And I don't know if it's maybe Director Patty also just popped in my brain. Of the 51 that had passed, or what is it, the 43, going back in our history, have you been able to find out if any of them had mental health issues?
You go over some of the, because we have the self-harm death analysis review team, and so we do go over some of those cases and analyze them. It's hard to see about mental health issues. Like going back to, we see like people having, it seems to be a common theme that we see of people having some sort of like injury description, use, drug abuse, and then going to other alternatives of heroin. So we do see that quite a bit. With mental health issues. I wouldn't say that's half. I would say there's some in there, though. It's hard because we haven't really analyzed that or looked at those. But we absolutely.
Is that something that you're going to, though?
Harm death analysis review team, we look at both suicide deaths as well as toxicity deaths. So that's something.
Because I think that'll help us in our continued arguments for mental health that we have in the city, but in the county. Obviously, dealing with here, but
Well, the care center moving to the new location here in the next few months here, and they have beds open for detox as well, so that'll be helpful. Not medical detox, but something, but I know that it's not easy. Everybody was simply not going to die from withdrawal. My experience with talking to people. And then going to the mental health part too. If we're in a scene, like I mentioned before, where we talk to the families about medical history and social history, things like that, like if the families disclose a mental health issue, is that necessarily going to go on the death certificate as to a cause of their attributing cause of this? No. And if we're suspecting a drug overdose, if there's a drug paraphernalia at the scene, they're known to be using, and everything is pointing to a drug overdose, then I'm not going to request medical records and then go through to find information about a prior mental health history, and then I couldn't disclose that information because of
you could collectively step here, but you could say if it doesn't break, you could say in the 43 deaths in our history, we identified mental health as being a factor in 50%. You could do a generic factor like that. Again, I don't think it would be hard science.
Sure.
Because you can't be comprehensive.
And it also be a matter of family that disclosed in that information, and I go over and I start.
And there's statements to that, and so I'm just not sure how accurate the data would be.
But that's the whole point of the SDR team, or self-harm death analysis, which we can see if there are trends. And we definitely saw pain management as an issue for a lot of people. We've seen things like divorce being another kind of trigger in other people, losing a lot in their life, and again, whether it's one factor or three factors, and I don't think it necessarily increases. I think it's a lot of time to test those agencies as well. But there's a lot of things that are targeted these areas, and the VA office being a point of work having Narcan is huge because they believe in it, and so therefore I think it becomes a question for other people to say, hey, this isn't such a bad idea. We wouldn't look for medication for other things for people can look at things for life. There's always that people saying, well, these people did this to themselves. They didn't have to do it. So
Do we know how many of the overdose individuals have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder? That would be interesting to know. Because I think that could be a contributing factor too.
Yeah, yeah. All of these things are contributing factors.
Yeah.
Certain mental health is a factor in opiate addiction. Certainly trauma, including post-traumatic stress, are significant factors. These are all factors. Now, folks who have other ways they're damaged are much more vulnerable to all of these things, right? I mean, we know that instinctively, right? So if you have some parts of you that are damaged, you're going to feel the effects of addiction in a way completely different than people who aren't damaged in some certain way.
Any other interested in having a generally, it's going to be an M3 this year, but at the job center, but sometimes it's not available. So those meetings will be posted on our website as well. So anybody is welcome to come. I think almost every meeting we have somebody new at the table. So, but again, we do have the people that are dedicated. We have been there since day one. Well, it's not just they came to one meeting and then they don't come. There's been a few that way, but I would say we probably have over 120 people on our email list. So there's a lot of people that are interested. It's just a few. Turn it over to the CA.
Hello, everybody. If you're anything like me, you're re-examining why you live in the state of Wisconsin. Here we are, keeping my coat on to maximize any heat I can preserve at this point. Thanks for asking me to come. I wanted to sort of really quickly talk about sort of where I think our strategies lie. First of all, one of the things that I've told people a number of times is that I think our county has made a very, very significant and excellent start towards providing real treatment in a number of different circumstances to folks who are addicted to opiates. Went to the DA meeting in early December, and it was a fun meeting for me because prosecutors would say, well, you know, there were these raising of hands, and people would say, well, have any of you guys heard anything about a first offense diversion program where you might not charge people with felonies and instead give them an opportunity for treatment? And I, of course, got to raise my hand and said, and they would say, well, you know, so you guys are thinking about doing that? No, we're already doing it. Well, so you started this month? No, we started 11 months ago. And so then they said, well, what about people who are almost on their way to prison and they're institutionalized in a jail and they have long-term addiction problems? Has anybody thought about treating them? And I was able to raise my hand and say, yeah, Kenosha does that too. How long have you been doing that? Well, we've been doing that for 2 years. And then somebody said, well, has anybody heard of this thing called Vivitrol? Got to raise my hand again. And they said, well, how many years have you been, you know, so, you know, are you exploring that now? No, we've been using that for 2 years, you know, as a process. So I got to be that guy in the room who already was, you know, had something happening all the time. And that's thanks to you guys and obviously to the county executive for putting those programs in place. So that was as much fun as a prosecutor can have with other prosecutors at a meeting. I became interested in this about 3 years ago and started to try to educate myself on this because I was the gun prosecutor in Orange County. And so every home burglary where a gun was stolen, I had the case. Okay, so you're looking at the guy who had, you know, I'm able to anecdotally tell you about every burglary where there was a gun because for 10 years, that's what I did here. And about 3 years ago, I began to see that everybody who got caught had an opiate addiction. Everyone who was doing a home burglary in this county, who was caught, we found at the root an opiate addiction. And that was weird to me because I thought, really, opiates are back? You know, I mean, I've been at this so long, I remember a prior opiate, you know, era from the late 80s, early 90s. And so this was amazing to me. And then I also do all the armed robberies. I did all the armed robberies in town here for 15 years. And so I, again, am a person who can tell you about every one of those cases in town here. And began to see also that everyone who was doing those robberies that take no preparation, where a person would walk into a convenience store and just rob it you know, getting whatever immediate cash, no planning, kind of, I need something right now, robberies. Extremely frequent in our gas stations and convenience stores, right? Every one of those at its root had an opiate addiction, right? So that's where I first got interested, because I read all the pre-sentences, and one after another, it was this same thing. And I began to read a very common process, which was somebody, well, it was not the drug addict that I remembered from my teenage DARE education, which was that the person would have used every drug under the sun for 10 or 15 years before they ever took heroin. And that heroin, the most expensive drug, was the drug that they sort of capped off their drug abuse career. You know, the concept in DARE that I remembered was you could kind of recognize even in high school who might be the heroin addict in the future, you know, because they were on this sort of trajectory. Well, none of the people I was looking at fit that. Instead, what people were is people who had some kind of injury, work-related or sports-related, had surgeries, never, ever got off opiates. Never got off, you know, and eventually made it to heroin. And so as I began to ask questions about that, I found out that heroin's the cheapest of the drugs, of the illegal drugs. So the economics of heroin are brutal to the crisis we're in. It's cheaper than the prescription pills that got them started, and it's cheaper than the other illegal alternatives that somebody might use for other purposes, like cocaine. And, of course, I knew the power of heroin and opiates to sort of decimate people. So, the medical examiner was very cautious with her numbers today, and she did that because she, but I'm an elected official, I don't have to be quite so cautious, so I'm going to tell you what I think those figures mean. So last year we had 54 deaths, in general of this toxicity issue, right? I am predicting that based on the numbers you heard today that we're going to be somewhere around 70 for this year, give or take. She has 30 pending. She's already close. For 2017.
Oh, okay.
She's at 51 now, 30 are pending. If you have a clear cut, if somebody kills himself with a shotgun, toxicity is not what you're waiting for, right? So these are all, of these 30, these are all ones where a reason why we're getting this toxicity test is because that is a very likely cause of death. Does everybody get me? So of this 30, a large proportion of those will be added to the 51. So my prediction, so if you guys want to start a pool, I'm saying around 70 total will be the total in conjunction, you know, different than 54. Correct me if I'm wrong, medical examiner. I believe will be a record of
that. So 40% increase.
If I was the smart ass DA that was being used, and you were saying all the things, I'd say, how can you get a higher drug test?
Well, I can't imagine you are such a person. I can't imagine that. I've known you long enough to know that could be it. But you know, the problem we have is a number of things, right? And you know these as well as I do. Where we have border proximity, we have issues of poverty and education and all the other criteria that are out there. And we are a place where this problem, you know, we are so close to major metropolitan areas, which are the direct source of this stuff, that we get it before some other places do. So I think proximity is a huge piece of that every time. You know, in every drug crisis, we suffer from proximity to two spots that can really be hot spots for us. So that would be my answer. But so let's say that I'm right and this is a horrible record-breaking year, okay? I also want to tell you, you know, because I get to be the doom and gloom on this day, I think this problem will get worse before it gets better. And I say that because of everything I've studied on this. Because as our doctors begin to wean people off of prescription medication, which is long overdue, okay, is decades overdue, but as we wean more and more individuals off these prescription medications, we don't end their addiction. And the economics of heroin is that it's such a cheap alternative and so dangerous, laced with fentanyl, as the crisis is now. I believe it will be worse. So again, my prediction is that 2018 is going to be worse than 2017, which I believe will be the worst year we've ever had for addiction. Do you disagree with any of that? I know you have to be cautious, but do you disagree with anything I just said?
So I mean, with 54 in 2016, that was our highest year to date.
Right.
So yeah,
we're going to break the record pretty certainly, and then You don't have any reason to believe that 2018 can be better rather than worse.
I'm hoping that it'll be better with our opioid task force and all the records that we're handing out and trying to educate the community.
So, and I hope so too. But I want to be sure you hear me say what I predict. So that I think is the magnitude of the problem. And then I'm going to talk about sort of the three things I'm up to. You know, these guys have talked about the other things that we're up to. But you guys have questions about the magnitude of the problem before I get on to what else?
Why does it take so long for us to figure out the test for toxicity analysis?
The toxicology is all done in-house at the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office. That's who we contract with. They have their own in-house lab. They are doing toxicology not only for their county, which it was an outrageous number of overdose deaths. So they're not only processing for their county, for our county, Racine, Jefferson, and Ozaukee. They have been going faster over the past year, so. It's been becoming faster.
What is the, is it time consuming? Is it time consuming?
It's the amount of cases that they have.
Well, I know, but once you have a person, you can worry
about it. Yeah, and then what happens from there is the doctor, then whoever the doctor is that performing the autopsy, that they have to review their findings from the actual autopsy itself. They have to interpret the toxicology results, and then they're the ones who are determining the cause of death, or I determine the manner of death, which is a separate issue.
So a lot of people touch it, but it's a good question. I'm not sure what the mechanics are in terms of the time. It's a multi-day test, though, right? They have to do one thing one day, one next.
They do an initial ELISA test, which is a screen. So then they're doing that first to see, okay, is there anything that comes up positive in that? Then they have to do the GC mass spec test, which is the gas chromatography mass spectrometry test, which is the gold standard in forensic toxicology. With the new fentanyl analogs, we've had a couple of cases where we have a person, they're dead of an overdose. We know that everything, they're a young person, there's drug paraphernalia, person has a history of drug use. Everything right there is looking like, this is a drug overdose. Toxicology comes back negative. Then we have to do more testing, has to be specialized testing, and then, by the way, here's some new fentanyl analogs that are coming through, so then they have to order more tests. Some of the fentanyl analogs aren't being picked up, like even in the hospitals with the screens they're initially doing.
How much do all these tests cost?
It all goes under one umbrella for our testing. So for the autopsy and toxicology, it's one price of $1,500. So if they have to do more testing, it's not an additional cost to us.
Could the hospital do the toxicology?
They are not the hospital. They are certified, and even like upstairs in our health department, they are certified for toxicology on the living, for antemortem toxicology. There's a separate certification for postmortem toxicology.
Because I just went through that. It was like 4 days.
So who monitors the cost of the toxicology tests or the autopsies to find where is the level where we would probably be better off doing it in-house?
So last year we were asked.
I think his point's good,
but
I think isn't there like outside labs that do it? Forget about the autopsy. Isn't it just a blood sample that they look at? Urine and blood?
It is. I mean, the toxicology we're talking about is blood.
So, I guess take a blood sample from this person. Can we ship that to an outside lab that is not part of the is that possible?
But then what? So then, OK, Okay, so if we were to just do a draw, like a blood draw on somebody that died and then sent it out for toxicology, could we do that? Yes. But then get the toxicology back to the dead of an overdose, then how do you prove if the person who gave them the drugs or sold them the drugs, how do you prove in a court of law that they didn't die of something else?
So what we're talking about here is if you don't do the tox in-house with the same people that you're asking to render an opinion, these are medical doctors who do autopsy,
yeah.
Right? So how do they know that lab test was properly tested? It's not their lab. How do they account for that factually? And how are they able to render that opinion?
Well, plus we're already paying them too.
Yeah, and I'm not sure there's not savings to have to do it in-house.
So the there's a couple different things also too. Like, so 2016 we had 158 autopsies that we had performed. This year we're at for 2017 we're at 179. So if we have anything that's a suspicious overdose, we're conservative in who we're having to have go to autopsy. But if the person has any history of abusing, they're going for an autopsy. If there's any suspicions at the scene, like there's paraphernalia, we're going to be sending them for an autopsy. If there is inconsistencies, like people lie to us, like when we're asking for the medical and social history, people lie to us and there starts to be these inconsistencies in their stories. Someone's sending it up here. And then we're finding drug overdoses that way too. Like, we have people who, for example, not this past year, but the year before, guy, he's in his mid-60s, he's overweight, he's on all sorts of medications, and he's dead at home on a couch. Looks like a normal guy. And then he has a ankle bracelet on, an ankle monitoring device. So why, I don't know why he has, we ask him, why does he have this? I don't know. Don't you know why your husband has this, okay? So, well then, we're bringing him an autopsy. Well, that's used out of a cocaine and heroin overdose. Yeah, so, when you have that going on too, you have to, any sort of red flag go up, do this in order to make sure that you're doing your job.
So, for us to be able to do it,
yes.
The cost. What does it cost if we were to do it ourselves? Because in 2 years we spent $500,000.
Well, go ahead, but cost is really off topic, so we'll keep that. And I think cost isn't what the subject is proposed. That's probably something finance would know. I just wanted to make sure that there was somebody on the county staff that was watching this to see when would be a time for the county to take it over rather than have it done outside. And and I don't mean to catch up, Andy, but I don't think cost was part of what we meant to talk here.
You probably wouldn't want to divide the two things up. So you'd probably make a county decision to have the autopsies done in-house, which of course we did for years. Or having done by the Milwaukee Medical Examiner's Office by contract, which is what we do now, which at least at the time seemed to be a savings. I mean, if it still is, or issues.
Yeah. That'd be something that
physical
and things like that. There also is the other part to take into consideration too, that there is a massive shortage of forensic board certified forensic pathologists. They are very, very hard to come by. A lot of doctors that are coming out of medical school, they are often going to private practice because it is a lot more money here in private practice than it is to work at a
psychologist. Recruiting was very difficult.
That's it.
So who do we need to bring in here to talk the cost? Because I'm hearing it's $1,500 to do a test. I'm hearing we're doing 158 last year, 179 this year. I mean, it's easy to put the numbers together on that. At what point, I mean.
So whoever from the, I mean,
Tammy, she took over Laura Stevens. give it up. Could be her and John Jansen.
Connie Jansen is, John Jansen's the one who supervises this.
Okay.
You said also from the prosecutor's.
Right.
I'd like to mention something about if the coroner's office doesn't do some toxicity report, it causes problems.
Right, so what happens is you remember that this medical examiner is a doctor who is pronouncing whether this level of toxicity, this reading of drugs caused the death or not, okay? If it's not a lab that he trusts, he or she trusts, or he or she can talk about as a reliable location, if it's not a lab where they have some direct information and investment in it, if they can't account for how the testing is done, et cetera, they're not, as a medical person, going to render an opinion about what that result is, okay? So a doctor's not gonna look at some test that's done by some outside agency that is not, you know, that they have nothing to do with and render an opinion.
Doctors and hospitals do that all the time.
If they have a specialized arrangement, they will. But this is about the cause of death. You know, this is not a plug in the numbers and there's an automatic result. This is a medical opinion about whether that particular level in the blood was a substantial factor in the death. And remember, most of these cases are complicated, right? The person's also got heart disease. Person's also got, you know, the person is also found, you know, out in the freezing cold. There's a whole set of things that happen. And so I'm just suggesting to you that they have one place do a result completely separate, and then to have a doctor who examines say, now I can render an opinion. Not even.
Yeah, I had another question. You're talking about you foresee a drastic increase. Or you still see it for sure an increase?
Yeah, I don't know how drastic, but it's going to get worse before it gets better.
We're looking at a 40% increase possible of the opioid deaths going from 54 to 70-ish. What can be done that we're not already doing? I mean, does it mean that we need to put people on a expressway and stopping vehicles? You know, I mean,
yeah. So
outside the box.
Well, so one of the things we need to do is we need to save more people. Okay, so I mean, you know, so what, you know, one of the things that I've really been a proponent of this year is normalizing Narcan training, having that be something that people think about as a common, everyday occurrence. Asking, you know, just like when people get CPR training or life, you know, breathing, but, you know, sort of life-saving training, that Narcan training be something that everybody gets. I had my entire office, 30 people, more than 30 people, get Narcan training. I would say 20 of them were skeptics. Basically, would have started me by saying, well, you know, why do I need to learn this? I'm probably not going to come across anybody. And, you know, I work in a DA's office. Why is this going to happen? And, you know, and aren't these people sort of, you know, getting into this themselves, right? And they left that training, as I was hoping, being people who appear to me to be saying, okay, now we know how to do this, now we're ready for this, and if there's ever a person we come across where their life could be saved, we're ready to do that. You know, just because somebody, let's say somebody doesn't know how to swim, and yet they love to spend time on boats in the water, okay? If that person fell in the lake and was drowning, there would never be a time where the group of us would discuss, well, you know, that person never really learned to swim, they're really responsible for the mess they're in right now. So, you know, we would never have that debate. We would jump in and save that life, and then we would try to teach that person to swim or do whatever we needed later, you know, and that's really the discussion this community wants to have. So I just think we need to be comprehensive by asking everybody involved. I mean, I call on all you guys, all of you men and women, to get Narcan training, do it publicly in a way where the populace understands that you did it because you felt it was necessary to help save lives. So that's one piece. And then the other two things we're doing, you know, I'm trying to ask people to have real conversations about this, and that, you know, that's what you're suggesting here is that you know, we're in denial that this is a problem. Everybody thinks, well, this could never happen to me or anybody I care about, and so you can never get past that. You can never have people really understand that the following. Only 10% of the people who have a dependent problem have ever, ever had treatment. 10% have ever had treatment. So, you know, you look at diabetes, 70% of the people who've had diabetes in this country have had treatment at some point. Okay? Hypertension, 70%. Opiate abuse, 10%. I'm not talking about people who had treatment and busted out of it or didn't do well, whatever. Only 10%. So, you know, we need to be as comprehensive as we can. We need to be, as you said, thinking out of the box to provide as many avenues and ways to get treatment as is humanly possible.
When you say the 10%, sorry to cut you off. When you say the 10%, that number tells me right away that it's obviously not people that are out causing crimes that are being incarcerated. Because people that are incarcerated go to treat.
The vast majority of them do not. Some of them,
they're Jew, they're me, they're
there's a couple of programs, right? There's a couple of programs for folks who are incarcerated. The vast majority of people who are incarcerated do not get any access. Some do, but it's again a small portion.
Do you think illegality what they're doing has something?
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of reasons.
You'd be afraid maybe to come forward and know you've done some crime.
Sure. Huge stigma, yeah. Right? I mean, the shame your family would have, the fact you can't admit it to your spouse. I mean, there's 100 reasons why. But that's what I'm saying. We got to have a real conversation in this community where we get past all of those things. And we say, this is such a community hazard to all of us that, you know, and not only to the person themselves, but to everyone around them, and frankly, the community as a whole, because the spiral of this addiction is that someday the vast majority of these people are certainly at high risk, right? Because that's where we get eventually. You know, we have this diversion program, right, that we've talked about a couple of times that you guys have been so generous in funding from the DA's office. And here's what we found. This is a shocking thing to me. We've offered this program, these services, to more than 20 people now. The average person in that program has been addicted to opiates for 9 years. This is the first time they've hit the justice system. So these are folks who now exhausted every other resource they had, and now they're starting to commit crimes, okay? And, you know, that was a surprise to me. I thought, well, these would be people who, you know, were addicts, started being an addict in January. But that's not the case at all. These are people, a lot of these people have had this trajectory because they've been on opiates, they've been on pain pills for years and years, and now they're cut off. So now here we are. So that's the common situation. So, you know, I do think those are the places we have to be. We have to be thinking about every way we can afford people treatment and ask people to be in treatment and ask families and members of the community to support treatment, even though people have done illegal things, even though people are, you know, have done shameful things. We need to get past it and try to give people opportunities for treatment. And just because they screw up in treatment once, we shouldn't be a community that says, well, we're never going to ever afford you treatment again. You know, the reality of this is people will not succeed in treatment many, many times for a variety of reasons. You have to keep the door open and continue to say there is treatment the moment that that you want to be more
secure.
Some
of the behavior change. So, like, if you, I mean, many of you may have started a New Year's resolution that I'm going to eat less or I'm going to exercise more. It's the same concept. They don't want to use the drug, but their body needs it. And it's not necessarily for that high, it's to maintain so they don't go through withdrawal.
And you know, you guys have heard me talk about brain chemistry change, which is so insidious. I mean, it's the scariest part of this. Your own brain turns against you. Now, what's scarier than that? And you know, here's what we've learned. So in our diversion program, again, a new thought process for me, the vast majority of people who fail in the first 3 months. If you can get them to that fourth shot, it's like the magic moment, right? You know, you still have a few stragglers who screw up after that, but if you can get them to that fourth shot, you've had them have a chance for 3-4 months to have that behavior start to adjust. And then if you get them to that fourth shot, you've had very few people who then have had a problem in the program. So the real difficulty for us, and for I think for everybody in this stuff, is how you get them through those first few months, you know, because we're not inpatient, right? You know, these are people who go back out.
So one question that came across my mind was, I noticed when you said that a lot of these addicts
you found that they've been robbing and stealing to get the money for the opiates. And with that thought in mind, I'm seeing now that we are charging these people for this treatment and for the Vivitrol. Is that going to discourage them from taking that treatment?
Well,
because they don't have the money to pay for the opiates, so how are they going to have the money to pay for the treatment?
We thought about that a lot, and you know, one of the things that I felt strongly, and you know, this is something I think people could really disagree, is that that people are more invested in something they have to pay something for, and so the concept here was that they would pay. We charge $400 to be in this program, so and we do payment plans. And you know, our program expects that you're going to be working because you're going to be able to maintain. You know, we've taken your craving away as the sort of model here, right? So we're expecting you to pay something, and we believe that that programs that require you to make some contribution, you know, that maybe changes the mentality. I could be wrong about that, but you know, that was my philosophy. You know, we're not going to ever recover the county's money dollar for dollar.
Right.
It's not a population that that's going to happen.
I just don't want people to be discouraged because they don't have a source of income.
Yeah. Well, we haven't turned anybody down. So we've had no one who said, I can't pay you, that we've not been able to work something out.
Okay.
What would you see in this situation where you wonder, what do you think you get caught robbing?
Yes.
Yeah, so do you offer as a bargaining chip to the sentence?
So no one who's been caught robbing would be eligible for this program. You know, that's a crime that's too serious for you to get into our first offender diversion program. Because remember that our program is actually offering you the opportunity to never be charged with a felony. And if you're actually robbing someone, and the same would be true of a home burglary, unless it was maybe to a family member who came to us and said, I would like you to do this. But if your home's been burglarized by someone, or you've been robbed at gunpoint, they're not that. The person who did that to you is not gonna be in this program.
If they were caught.
If they were caught, right. No, that's true. Yeah, somebody could have done that and we didn't know it and we caught them on something else, definitely. But yeah, so that would never happen. But so the typical case we have is we catch somebody with fentanyl or heroin. Okay, so they're caught, there's a traffic stop, they're driving erratically, and now we find them with the substance, right? So we offer them from the jail an opportunity. We'll tell them, if you can make it through this program, you will never be charged with the felony. Okay? And this is a person who does not yet have a criminal record. And so we say, you have to go to detox, meaning you have to go to the care center, and you guys have expanded the beds to help make these programs possible this year. If you can make it through the care center, which is a tough several days, that's a rough period. We've lost several people, they just couldn't do it. Okay? If you walk out, it's not a locked facility, then we charge you with the crime that you were arrested for. But if you make it through those, then you get your Vivitrol shot, now you're back in the community. Okay, so you have the difficulty that you're back in that environment, but the craving is gone. And now you have to get invested in treatment with us. We don't expect it, certainly in those first few months, for you to be perfect, but we do expect you to be crime-free, which, you know, you were doing before this, and we expect you to go to treatment. We expect you to be in treatment. Even if you can't handle it yet, even if it's not working yet, you have to be in it. And we found that model to work about 2 in every 3 cases. It's certainly not going to work for everybody. That's been the model so far.
Very good.
We have 2 people this year. Next year, we will get their 12th injection. So we have 2 people who made it through the entire program. There are 12 people in the program now. At any given point, there's been about 12 people. We had a woman get her children back, so now the cost of the county of social services, of foster care and all that is done. And we had one other person who was being supervised, her children were and the children in the care for their children that were terminated in that case, so we're saving some.
So right now with Vivitrol, it's for first-time offenses. And for those that are about to be incarcerated?
Nonviolent.
So ours are, mine are for first offenders, this DA program, right, that you funded. But then also, there's another program that was the original program. There's also the withdrawal, which are people who are just on the verge of going to prison.
Okay.
So their probation is being messed up because of this person. And those are longer term addicts. Those are people who have much more chronic addiction.
Sure.
So we're dealing with both those two populations.
So it was brought up in a board meeting about, you know, it's great. It's two great programs. Is there anybody looking at the middle group?
Right. And that is a place where no one in our county right now has a specific program for. So that is definitely the piece that is, you know, that we don't have in existence.
Is there anybody looking to put that together?
So it wouldn't be me because I don't have a thing I can do for them in terms of charges. So I would not be the person to do that. So again, the people to talk to would be the health department folks about that. Because that's the next level expansion from the piece where I sit. That's the niche of people we don't have. So for instance, a program that exists right now is in Lake County. If you have an opioid problem and you are at that moment you want to change your life and get off them, you can walk into any police station in Lake County and they will get you a treatment bed. They have a funded source where that county has said, if you walk into a police department and say, I need help, I have an opioid addiction, they will put you in a treatment program.
So that's bring John in and talk to him about it.
Yep.
It's called The Way Out, that program. My clients call The Way Out, and then you can also turn over your you can't come in with like a kilo cocaine. You know, there's parameters, but like if you have a skill.
But that would get that meal group. You know, that would be, you wouldn't have to have a crime. You know, to get in my program, you have to have been arrested for a crime, right? Mm-hmm. So the other thing we don't have is we don't have a program that we're talking about right now for the person whose mom or dad just wants, you know, calls you and says, hey, my kid is on a heroin and I don't know what to do. He hasn't committed a crime yet. I mean, a crime that he's been caught for. He's obviously going to get a crime every day. But that's a niche that we don't have to deal with, that we don't have anything to deal with right now either. Is that just that concerned parent who says, my kid is such and such, we don't have a way to, you know, there's no way to force somebody into treatment. But we don't even have anything specifically to offer them as a county right now that does that. Now, there's all sorts of private hospitals, there's all sorts of things. Insurance covers some of that, but there isn't a comprehensive program in this county.
I don't know if anybody has the knowledge on this, but if we hit that head on, or if we started working on that, do you think that would have an impact on our mental health in the county? Do you think it's related at all?
So I can tell you in our diversion program, if you look at the statistics we gave you, I think we said 70% of our folks self-report. Yeah, so about halfway down we're on the biggest 12 demographics, about halfway down that first page. We've reported, now remember we only have about 20 people.
70% have mental health.
70% have mental health history or diagnosis.
So they're almost absolutely.
These are first time through folks.
Sure.
Yeah, but you know, and again, we're only talking about 20 people, so this is not scientifically.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
But again, I mean, the diagnosis, it's a lot of times they separate mental health and mental health and substance abuse. They are most healthy.
Oh, sure.
So, people are self-medicating.
So I personally think, yes, there will be an impact.
Yeah, I do too. I do too.
But I think the ER, the peer support going into ER is going to help. Some, but not everybody, because we don't want people to get to that overdose level, because again, they don't always make it. I think there's got to be a lot of done prevention too, and everybody always says, you know, how do you get into the schools? The schools are so packed with so much that they have to be on a school board, and I just know that it's, you know, it's tough. You know, there's lots of things on the internet. What do you believe? What don't you? I mean, just even having those conversations with your kid, and you know, if you have a family history, letting people know, you know what, if you had alcoholism in our family, probably not a good idea to drink.
Sure.
Or if you do, it's, you know, one or two, not let's see how drunk you can get. But it's again, it's not socially acceptable.
And the whole thing where there's not the same stigma on pills among young people or anybody else as there is everything else, right? So, you know, if you're a kid and somebody hands you a pill and says, take this, it's not as scary, clearly, as somebody who came over to you with a needle, you know. But the problem is that pill is what gets you going. You know, that's the piece. So, you know, one of the problems is to just educate, you know, parents and kids themselves that that these pills are powerful opiates. They get people addicted after we get 4 out of every 5 of our new heroin addicts came from pain pills.
You know, you mentioned 63% are employed. Are there employers in the ones?
Not for us. We don't talk to the employer. We don't contact your employer as long as you're going to work. We're not like probation where they have to know who that person is. But you're asking, like, would we have talked to bosses and say, hey?
Well, yeah. I know that in summers, EMS has gone up in other calls about 30%. A lot of times they're over at Amazon with guys OD. I mean, it's true. That's what I was told.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a lot or summer, but I would think Amazon should be responsible for their health. I mean, it's for health insurance and education and all that.
Yeah.
But you would go to one of our facilities and we'd do this part of the COVID.
Yeah.
Well, if you go to your employer, my understanding is, and tell them that you have an addiction issue, your employer can help you with that,
yeah.
And you're not going to be losing the job.
Right.
Whereas if your employer comes to you and says, you've got a problem, you got to go. There's a big difference.
It's
educating people to let them know.
It is, but that's a tricky spot for employers to let somebody go. Yeah, that's,
it is, but I think it does happen. But the other thing is, too, I mean, we are working on educating businesses in the area because a lot of the overdose deaths, too, are happening in parking lots and things like that. It's not that.
And you might want to start with Amazon.
Well, there's also the fact that a lot of those employees, there are seasonal employees. And I've worked at a seasonal facility before, not the one you just spoke of, I know people were going out in the middle during lunch and smoking or doing whatever they're doing because you can smell it when they come back. So supervisors tend to turn their nose to it, which is terrible.
They need workers.
Because they need the workers,
yeah.
Because it's the seasonal.
And you don't have to check the box if your name is on the building. So, very well.
I mean, it's a good thought that employers are a place that nobody really has taken this in any kind of way.
The other thing I bring up too is with the Narcan brand and with the opioid task force and all of us working together, again, the Narcan out to the different police agencies, even to my deputy medical examiners, we've had 7 Narcan saves over the past year, or since what, May? So that's 7 less deaths on my caseload. So that's I don't even know about, that are self-reporting too. So how many do we not know about that are happening? So I think it's a big factor to get that dark in. That's why I for the packets and everything else to get this out to the public so that they know about it, to get it into the hands of the community. So that if somebody has an overdose, that they can be saved and not end up with me.
We just have a new app too that just went out at the, if you go to Cinemark, our Narcan app is running for 6 months now. It talks about getting trained, so if you see it.
Yeah, I personally would want to say thank you to all of you. I think it has a positive effect on reducing crime. I think we can get at that middle group and be a little more proactive. That could help reduce our crime numbers, but Mike, I think you're doing a great job, all of you. It's just, I can't thank you enough. Great job.
If you guys have some other ideas, please, I'm always happy to listen.
Yeah.
This is something that's going to continue to be a problem for us.
And before you leave, I'd like you to stick around for committee members' comments.
Okay.
Anybody have any other questions? Committee member comments. Okay. I was a combat veteran in Vietnam, and some extreme combat situations. And when I came home, the VA, not at my request, told me I had post-traumatic stress disorder. I had a hard time getting back into normal life as a veteran. And where I'm going with this is, I was seriously concerned on the finance committee when we brought up the cost for Veterans Court, and Mr. Rose seemed to think there weren't enough participants to justify keeping it going. I personally know how important it is. I lived it. I was there. I drank a lot. I had a hard time
Well, maybe I didn't get caught breaking laws, but I know I did my share of drinking when I came home. And a lot of these veterans, my heart goes out to them, you know, where they got multiple deployments. And if there's anything we can do to support that program, I mean, we've got five veterans on the county board right now, and we're all, I believe, supportive, and whatever help we could get, we sure would like to see it.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have very clearly expressed that to me, and the mandate to my my prosecutors are to look for people who are the appropriate candidates. I wanted to be frank with you, and that is the stumbling block so far has been defense attorneys have not been interested in putting their folks in, so it's not been a prosecutor issue. And what I continue to hear defense attorneys tell me is that the supervision for Veterans Court for their clients is more strict because there's more services being provided, there's more things that their client would have to do than a normal probation would be, or a normal sentence would be for the same offense. So we're having difficulty figuring out what offenses we can do that will get defense attorneys to be willing to recommend these services to their client. But we're working on that. We've had a couple of educational meetings with the defense bar to try to help get past that. We've been working on this for since late November, when a couple of folks approached me and said that we really needed to focus on this, and so we have been doing that.
Thank you very much. Really, we need your support. We'll have to get Mr. Rose to talk to some defense attorneys.
Yeah, we need the support.
Should the VA be involved?
They provide the funding. Yeah, the impediment is not that the treatment is not available.
Right. From what I understand, the Milwaukee VA and the Wayne County are very good. Very good. From what I hear, their treatments are top. What I've heard. They're almost better than
the treatment, but I'm talking about the Veterans Court.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
Any other comments? I want to thank you again for all you've done. Great job. Great presentation. Keep up the good work. Thanks so much. Okay. We're motion adjourned. A motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting adjourned. Thank you very much.
All right.
No problem.